Happy New Year. I suspect that many of us have used that phrase already quite a lot over the past few days, and maybe even in the past hour or so. Happy New Year. It's my opportunity to say that to all of you together, so I don't have to go past each of you individually. But do you ever stop to think about that phrase? Happy New Year. In some ways, it's just a greeting, isn't it? Something that marks a specific thing that's going on. It's a bit like happy birthday is basically a way of saying, I've remembered it's your birthday, are you impressed? But I wonder if you consider this for a few moments. What would make this year, 2025, a happy one? Have a think. What would make 2025 a happy year for you? I'm leaving it quite a while so you actually think about it. There might be some things that you're looking forward to in 2025. And you'd be happy if they go well. So maybe you're getting married. Maybe you're looking forward to success in exams. Maybe you're looking forward to the birth of a new family member. Maybe a happy new year would be work-related, a new job. Maybe it's just hopes for stability. A year without health scares. A year without arguments. When Ewan and I were talking about today's title, I actually wanted to call it A Happy New Year because it looks like we couldn't think of a title for the first Sunday of January. But the truth is that today we are going to be thinking precisely about the greatest promise for a Happy New Year. We're going to launch into 2025 with great hope because we're thinking about the start of Jesus' public ministry as it was recorded by Luke. Now, it's fitting, actually, because over the past few weeks, we've been thinking a bit about Christmas, haven't we? God with us. Hope is here. Here is hope. And that's where Luke starts his gospel, with the angels visiting Mary and Mary singing and visiting and John the Baptist being born, and the angels announcing the Jesus of birth to the shepherds, and all of that kind of stuff. But once the birth of Jesus is over, then Luke kind of almost presses fast forward. So he almost glances over 30 years' worth of Jesus' life. He effectively goes from Jesus' birth, and then is a little bit about an incident that happens in Jesus' childhood, and he moves straight on to the section that we're looking at now, the start of Jesus' ministry. It's the next episode, as far as Luke is concerned, which is why, I guess, if you're online or if you're here and this is your first experience of church after Christmas, well, you've not missed anything. You've not missed anything. Now, you'll notice if you keep your Bibles open on page 1031, if you've got a church Bible, we're going to be focusing, if you like, on three different scenes. Luke records three different scenes in this section. I'm going to make it clear because although there's three scenes, we're going to pick out the big themes that cut across them. I'm not going to address them all separately. So have a look at these three scenes. They've all actually been helpfully divided in the Bibles. With their own heading. The first is from verses 16 to verse 30. If you like, this is Jesus' public launch. And then from verses 31 to 37, he teaches people in Capernaum in the synagogue. And then finally, in verses 38 to 44, he's still in Capernaum and he heals Peter's mother-in-law and many others. Three different scenes, but all with the similar themes running through them. And we're going to see those themes by focusing, if you like, particularly on the first of those scenes. It's the one that Luke goes into more detail on. It's the one he gives more time to. And that's the one we're going to focus on most. Because I think this first scene is just so important to understanding who Jesus is and why he has come. I think this is like his product launch, if you like. I'm sure you might be aware of sort of product launches. It's the moment when something goes public. I was imagining this kind of scene. Loads of time and money gets spent thinking about how to launch a new product. The masters of the product launch are probably Apple. The inventors of the iPhone, the iPads, the iEverything. But what happens? First of all, you get a build-up of the hype, don't you? Rumours start emerging. What's going to be on this new iPhone? Or is it going to have a charger with a USB-C? Or is it going to have the old lightning cable? Are you going to get headphones with it, or is it wireless? You get these little rumours that start spreading around. People talking about it, what will it be like? Then you pick a venue, usually surrounded by glitz and glamour. Maybe a red carpet with celebrity endorsements. The PR people carefully orchestrate everything to ensure that there's no distractions. There's press releases already prepared to accompany the launch to have maximum impact. And then finally, the star takes center stage. So if we're thinking Apple, think Steve Jobs, the first iPhone. He moves onto this dark stage and he's there in his black polo neck jumper. And behind him is a giant screen, about 15 times bigger than that one. And on the giant screen, he says, "We've created a new device, the iPhone," and there it is. Massive, right behind him. You can't avoid it. He pales into insignificance because all you get is a star of the show. Everyone's attention. There's universal hollers and cheers and applause. That is a good product launch. It makes an impact. So, what about Jesus' launch? What about Jesus' ministry launch? Well, what does he do? Well, the first thing he does, or the first thing that Luke records for us, is that Nazareth is the place to record Jesus' launch. His first public words. Now, Nazareth is the place where Jesus grew up. It's a fitting place. It's his hometown. The local lad surrounded by family and friends. What a great place to launch something new with big impact. And notice if you look at verses 14 and 15, there's already a bit of buzz. The rumors are spreading. The hype has been growing because he's been in Galilee. He was teaching in their synagogues. Verse 15, everyone praised him. Verse 14, news about him spread throughout the entire countryside. Imagine the scene. You're there in Nazareth and there's all this buzz and people are flocking to the synagogue to hear about this new teacher that they'd heard about. They're fighting for the front row seats because they want to get the best view. And the moment comes. They're there, much in church, a bit like us. And Jesus does exactly what he'd done elsewhere. He goes into the synagogue and they have a Bible reading, much as we do here. He stood up. They handed him a scroll, which was from the prophet Isaiah. He unrolled it, he read it, he rolled it back up, he handed it back and sat back down. Now, that might sound a bit random, but actually, this is carefully orchestrated. If not by Jesus' PR people, certainly by Luke. Because if you notice the structure, Jesus stood. They handed him a scroll. He unrolled it. He found the place and read. But then everything else goes back in reverse next, doesn't it? He rolled it back up. He gave it back. He sat down. Now, this is something that you may well be familiar with in the past. This structure is there. It's, if you like, a Bible sandwich. I think that's how I've heard Ian Jones refer to it in the past. a Bible sandwich or a burger. You see, you've got the bread on either side, but the important thing is the meat in the middle. So what is Luke saying here? He's saying the most important thing in Jesus' product launch, Jesus' ministry launch, is what he reads, what he has to say. So what does he read? Have a look with me, verse 18 and following. The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And then he sat down. Can you imagine what the scene must have been like? Everyone sat down there, eyes fixed on Jesus. What is going to happen next? Well, what does Jesus say? He said, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And all spoke well of him and were amazed at his gracious words. This is like the best launch ever. It's going so well, isn't it? Everybody's loving this. He's read from Isaiah, and, well, we're going to see in a minute, this is all about good news. And people are like, wow, this is brilliant. Love it. You see, Jesus, first of all, brings good news. This passage that Jesus read in Isaiah 61 would have been precious to the people because it's a passage all about hope in the midst of despair. Isaiah the prophet lived about 700 years before Jesus. This is a bit of an aside, a bit of background, if you like, context about Isaiah. He was sent by God 700 years before Jesus to speak to the nation Israel about a judgment they were going to experience, because they'd turned their back on God. They were going to be kicked out of the land of Israel, and God would judge them. The city of Jerusalem would be destroyed. That's the main message of the first half of the book. And that prophecy proved true. Israel was taken by the Assyrians and then the Babylonians, and the whole nation did lose its land and go into exile. It's pretty rubbish news. But from chapter 40 onwards in Isaiah, his focus shifts to one of hope. What would come after that exile? And what the promises are of Isaiah is that God's kingdom is coming. You will return home, he says. You will be a light of hope to the nations. And it's all going to be achieved through one man, a servant. A suffering servant who would be rejected and killed but come back to life again. Who would announce God's news, good news to the poor. Now, any of you who know your New Testament well would see the links here that Jesus is already making. But although the nation of Israel had returned from exile about 500 years before Jesus, they haven't received these blessings. So everyone who was sat there in that synagogue that day would have been waiting for God's good news to happen. 500 years they've been waiting for the one empowered by God's Spirit, for God's King, the Messiah, who would deliver all those beautiful promises. But I suspect they might have got weary in their hope. I don't know about you, but Christmas was not that long ago. I mean, how hard is it to wait until after lunch for your Christmas presents? Anyone struggle with that? Yeah, Ian Fenton did. I remember growing up in my childhood. Like, we had to wait until we washed the dishes before we... Exactly, it's like... my parents aren't here. They're probably online. So I won't say anything about child abuse or anything like that. But no. You see, it's really hard to wait sometimes. God's people have been waiting 500 years for the best of news, for this good news to come. And what does Jesus say? He says, "Today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." You've been waiting 500 years. Well, here I am. wait no more. What a launch. Not just an answer to a problem that maybe some people have, but an answer that people have been waiting 500 years for. So let's look at the bit that Jesus chooses to read. The Spirit of the Lord is on him as the Lord has anointed him to proclaim good news to the poor. He's on a mission from God. We'll come back to that anointment thing just very briefly later on. But let's have a look at the content of what it is that he proclaims. The good news matches the needs of the person. Good news, he says, to the poor. This isn't like wealth to the poor. No, instead, poor people, the poor, are those who realize their poverty, their need. And then he explains that a little bit more in the next few verses. Freedom for the prisoners, sight to the blind, freedom for the oppressed. You see, what Jesus is promising in terms of good news to the poor is a reversal of everything that is wrong with the world. What Jesus promises is to meet the ultimate need that defines somebody. So prisoners, they're defined by being in prison. The opposite is freedom. The blind, they are defined by their lack of sight. And so the opposite is seeing. The oppressed, their ultimate need is to be released from their oppressors. You see, these things appear physical, but the likelihood is that it's not just a physical thing. People are deprived of freedom in all sorts of ways that isn't being in prison. But sometimes we're held captive, aren't we, by our fears? So we are prisoners because of our fears. We are maybe fearful of going out, fearful of being rejected, fearful of saying the wrong thing. All kind of fears that restrict us. Well, what Jesus is promising to do is to reverse everything that is wrong with the world. That's what's meant by that phrase, the year of the Lord's favor. Jesus announces a new year, a happy new year, in verse 19. Now, again, just as an aside, the year of the Lord's favor was a specific year, every 50 years in the Old Testament. It was often called the Jubilee. And in that year, it was like the slate was wiped clean. That everything that had counted against people before was no longer there. It was gone. So what did that include, specifically? Specifically, debts. Debts were forgiven. If you owed anybody any money in the Jubilee year, that was wiped out. Israelite slaves set free. Land returned to its original owners or their descendants. So in other words, if a person had fallen on hard times and was forced to sell his land or himself to sell off debts, that sale was never permanent. Both land and people were set free in the Jubilee. So can you see why the year of the Lord's favor, this Jubilee year, is great news? It's forgiveness, it's freedom, it's rest, it's the Lord's favor, the Lord's smile on you. And Isaiah 61 actually goes on to talk about more things. Comfort for those who mourn, bestowing on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair, instead of shame, a double portion, instead of disgrace, rejoice in your inheritance. In my faithfulness, I will reward my people and make an everlasting covenant with them. Can you see how this is a reversal of everything that stands against people? The year of the Lord's favor is a complete turnaround, a meeting of all needs. You see why this is good news? Well, those who were sitting there, we'd have also noticed that Jesus stopped in the middle of a sentence. Because in Isaiah 61, if Jesus had read the full sentence, he would have said this: to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God. But Jesus stopped. He stopped because, yes, there is a day of judgment in the future. But now he's proclaiming the year of the Lord's favor. In other words, now is the time for salvation. But it's not just that he talks about good news. Did you see in our reading earlier on that he himself is good news? See how in the next few incidents that we read earlier, he goes on to fulfill these promises. Verse 33, in the synagogue there was a man possessed by a demon, an impure spirit. Well, what happened? Jesus said, be quiet, come out of him. And the demon threw the man before them all and came out without injuring him. You see, Jesus rescues and frees the oppressed. Then in verse 39, Jesus heals Simon's mother-in-law from a fever. And throughout the day, they come at sunset, and throughout the night even, verse 40, the people brought to Jesus all who had various kinds of illness, and laying his hands on each one, he healed them. You see, Jesus doesn't just talk about good news. Jesus is good news. Each of these people was captive to something that they had no control over. Whether it be a demon or sickness, they were powerless. But Jesus breaks in with authority and rescues them. He saves them. He does what he says. So I just want you to think back. What would make 2025 a happy new year for you? I want to ask you now, are your hopes big enough? Are your hopes big enough? If you were to think about what you were pondering earlier on, is that really your biggest need? Is that the biggest thing that stands against you now? Are your hopes for 2025 for things, stuff that will be lost or quickly forgotten in times to come? Because what Jesus says is that this, now even, is a time of the Lord's favor, where our ultimate needs are met. So friends, what do you need? Forgiveness? Comfort for those who mourn? Hope for the hopeless? Acceptance from God? In the words of the Christmas carol, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in Jesus tonight. And that is good news. It's good news for the whole world. Did you notice what happens, though? It doesn't quite go as expected. Jesus' product launch is going brilliantly. Absolutely brilliantly, and all are speaking well of him. Have a look, verse 22. All spoke well of him, were amazed at his gracious words that came from his lips. And they said, isn't this Joseph's son? And you might be a bit surprised by what Jesus says next. Because Jesus doesn't say, yes, I am. You got it? Do you recognize me? Bit more of a beard. He doesn't say that. Instead, he seems a bit angry by their response. Have a look. Jesus said to them, surely you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself, and you'll tell me, do here in your hometown what we heard that you did in Capernaum. Well, verse 23 doesn't seem to answer the question, does it? Isn't this Joseph's son? And then Jesus starts talking about physicians healing themselves. But it is a complete turnaround in the conversation. Because Jesus, I think, is responding to the sentiment of the question. He's responding not to the specific words, but actually to their localized way of thinking. Well, I was thinking a lot about this. I mean, I spent a long time trying to work out what on earth there was going on with the Joseph's son. And there's still lots of interpretations out there. It could be amazement, like, look how he's grown. It could be that they're making fun of him. He's only a little carpenter's son. It could be a, hang on a sec, don't I recognize you? Isn't that Joseph's son? But I think in this instance, we need to just go to what Jesus' response is. Jesus' response is all about them asking for him to perform some miracles for them. Did you notice that? He starts to think about what's going on under the skin. And I think this is what's going on. If we thought that the best place for a launch of a public ministry was a homecoming launch, that you'd get the most favorable response to accompany the launch, then what you would do is you'd do your biggest and your best miracles. If you wanted to make the biggest impact, you'd be like, right, you've heard about that stuff I've done in Capernaum, watch this. And people would be like, yeah, Jesus, we know who you are now. This is amazing. But Jesus refers back, doesn't he, to the Old Testament prophets. He talks about Elijah and Elisha. Now, Elijah lived in a time of famine. There were many people starving at the time of Elijah, and he was sent to help a widow who was hungry and starving, but not one in his hometown. Not even in Israel. One in a foreign country, Sidon. God blessed a foreigner through Elijah. And then Jesus says, yeah, not just Elijah, there's Elisha as well. There were plenty of people in Israel with leprosy at the time of Elisha. But Elisha didn't heal any of them. No, instead he healed another foreigner, Naaman. You see, God sent his prophets to bring blessing to other nations. Israel couldn't restrict or keep God to themselves. God's plans were always bigger than them. And in fact, God was actually angry with those who presumed he only cared about them. I think that's where this conversation's going too. I think what they're doing is that they're kind of like, we were brought up with you, Jesus. You're Joseph's son, aren't you? You know, like, I was watching the darts for my sins. I was watching the darts. Luke Littler's got all these hangers on. All this entourage, all these people that, oh yeah, we're mates with you. Come and throw some darts, give us some money. This, that, and the other. You can imagine that with Jesus. Jesus, we grew up together. You're Joseph's son, we go back years. Do some stuff for us. And I think that's why Jesus actually responds why he does. He isn't going to feel obliged to them. They presume on Jesus that he was there just for them. But instead, he's on a mission from God, not a mission from them. Notice how also in verse 42, this same pattern continues. At daybreak, Jesus went out to a solitary place, and the people were looking for him. Why? When they came to him where he was, they tried to keep him from leaving them. You see, the people wanted Jesus to themselves. They didn't want to share him. They wanted what he could bring. But Jesus summarizes his mission in verse 43. It's to proclaim the kingdom of God everywhere. God's kingdom is global. And that's why it's good news for us. Everyone here today, whether you've been in and around church for years or this is your first time, God's kingdom extends to Rotherham 2,000 years after these first words were spoken. But it's not just for us, is it? I wonder if there's a danger sometimes that we have a similar way of thinking to the people in Nazareth. A thought that can creep into our minds that somehow we deserve God's blessings. Maybe we've been around Jesus for years, or as those of us who've been brought up in church should expect. Somehow, well, of course I'm a Christian. Of course I'm part of God's kingdom because, well, I'm part of this family. My parents went to church, and their parents before them, of course. Maybe, although we wouldn't say it out loud, we might begrudge sharing Jesus with others. Struggling to rejoice when we see God blessing others in other churches. But the promises of Isaiah were for all nations. And Jesus reiterates this by saying that God's kingdom is for all. And so this is good news for all of us. The year of the Lord's favor, a time of salvation, of God meeting our deepest needs of forgiveness, becoming friends with him. And that is something we're all invited to. But also it's something that goes out to the world. As REC, what kind of church do we want to be? 2025 is a year actually where we continue to go beyond these walls into our communities because Jesus brings good news to the whole world. And then finally, because of who he is, because he's the Son of God. The identity to Jesus is key to understanding how he brings about the Lord's favor. I think Luke is really explicit in this passage about talking the importance of who Jesus is. I wonder if you notice some of the different names that crop up in this passage for Jesus. Just have a look up on the screen. Oh, they're not up on the screen. Because I didn't put that on my slide. I wrote it in here, but I didn't put it on my slide. So don't look at Nick, look at me. The different ways that Jesus is described. He's described as the Holy One of God. He's described as Jesus of Nazareth. He's described as Joseph's son. He's described as the Messiah. He's described as all these different names. So the question is, well, what difference does it make? Different responses to who Jesus is. That'll be why. I've got a page missing. Okay. Now Nick really doesn't know where we are. Thank you, Nick. Oh, here we go. Yeah, verse 22. Isn't this Joseph's son? Verse 34, Jesus of Nazareth. Verse 34 again, the Holy One of God. Verse 41, the Son of God. Verse 41, the Messiah. So this is the final theme we're going to draw out. I want to pick up on two responses. I guess you could say that the keep him to ourselves response is another one, but two responses that are not good. First is this. He's a good man. He's a good man. Jesus comes back to the crowd. This comes back to the crowd in Nazareth. They spoke well of him. They were amazed at his words, but they couldn't get past him being Joseph's son. That might be that they wanted to keep him to themselves, but I think Luke is also weaving a little thread through this passage, which is to say that if Jesus is primarily Joseph's son, then what they're saying is that he's just a good man. Focusing on his, if you like, human father. Yes, he might have great teachings. Yes, he might be doing all wonderful things, but he's a man. And this idea often sounds so flattering. He's so wise. But how does Jesus respond to the he's just a good man? Well, he's not flattered. Instead, he comes back and says, is that all you think of me? The crowd get angry at Jesus' response, don't they? They want to control him. But because he challenges him, he challenges them, the story takes a sinister turn. Have a look at verse 28. It says this, all the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, took him over to the brow of a hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. They wanted to reduce Jesus to Joseph's son so they could control him. But Jesus can't be fobbed off as such an impressive man. He's much more than that. And when he refuses to be limited or controlled by them, they try to control him differently by killing him, by getting rid of him. Now, this is a huge challenge to a world that has a range of opinions on Jesus, but fundamentally one that focuses purely on his humanity, his wisdom, or his teaching falls short of who Jesus really is. And it's a backhanded way of trying to control him, trying to limit him to fit our narrative. And that is probably the belief of most people these days. But Jesus would challenge him. Then the second negative response, he's God's king, but not my king. You had mentioned this earlier on. The demons speak of Jesus as, well, they know who he is, don't they? Verse 34, go away. What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. Verse 41, you're the Son of God. They knew he was the Messiah. The demons knew who Jesus was. They say it out loud. They reveal it to those listening in. But despite knowing his true identity, they don't want anything to do with him. And this belief has the same conclusion as the first. Opposition to Jesus. They don't want him ruling them, just like the people that did in Nazareth. But there is also even something more sinister, because they know who Jesus is and choose to reject him. And Jesus judges them, doesn't he? He casts them out from the people whom they oppressed. Well, those are two negative responses. Finally, we have Luke's response, or Luke's interpretation. We don't actually get a fully positive response to Jesus in this passage. Perhaps Simon's mother-in-law, because she gets healed and then the first thing she does is to get up and wait on them. But I suspect that might be force of habit. Jesus, you've healed me. Would you like a cup of tea? But what does Luke choose to identify Jesus as? How does he emphasize? Well, I want to just pick up on four things briefly. He is genuinely amazing, first of all. Everyone praised Jesus. All spoke well of him. The people were amazed at his teaching. All the people were amazed. Four different times it says that. Jesus is genuinely amazing. Secondly, he is in absolute control. When the crowds try to force him over the cliff, he walks through the crowds. They can't hold him. Thirdly, he is absolutely kind. The words he speaks are gracious, not condescending but concerned, loving, kind to the needy and the outcast. He's absolutely kind. And then he's anointed to proclaim the Lord's favor. This is what God's king is like. Jesus is the king of God's kingdom, a kingdom of grace that extends to the marginalized, a kingdom for people who know their need and are humble enough to ask, a kingdom of freedom, a kingdom of favor, a kingdom where all that was wrong is made right. You want 2025 to be a happy new year? Well, come to this king. Come back next week. Hear more of this king. And meet this king. Because he brings good news for all people because of who he is. He's a beautiful Savior.